Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And this is the first show of 2014. I'm so happy to be here with all of you in the new year, and I hope you all had a wonderful celebration and had some time to contemplate and to think about some New Year's resolutions and intentions as we go forward into this new year. And I know I mentioned a few on my newsletter this past week that I borrowed from the Food Tank website. Food Tank is a wonderful think tank for food and sustainability, and they put out 14 food resolutions. That was really great. And then into yesterday's New York Times in the dining section, they had some great sustainable food resolutions. And I'd just like to share some of them with you because I think they are so simple and so easy to do. And if we all, you know, make these transitions over to some of these choices, we will all be eating better, we'll be healthier, and the planet will reap the benefits as well. So they're good. One of them is to just every week steam a whole bunch of fresh vegetables. And that just parboils them. Don't cook them all the way. Just parboil them so that they're in the fridge and they can be whipped up really quick. Whether you want to whip them up into a puree or a soup or a stir fry, whatever, it just will save some of the cooking time during the week if you're, you know, coming home from work and you need to whip something up quickly. They also recommend cooking big batches of grains and beans. And I do that. I always have, if you don't cook the beans, you know, fortunately we do have some really good quality canned beans that you can purchase. I know I've mentioned this before, but if you're going to purchase canned beans, try to find ones that have kombu in them. It just helps with the digestion of the beans. And Eden Brand has that. But otherwise, cook the beans. If you have a pressure cooker, cooking beans is a no-brainer. It's very easy and it goes very quick. And the pressure cookers of today are not the fearsome pressure cookers of the past. I remember as a kid exploding a pressure cooker all over the ceiling of my kitchen, and then it took me years before I ever would use one again. It was so traumatic for me. But the pressure cookers nowadays really have a lot of safety gadgets, and so it's much easier, and you're not going to explode the pressure cooker all over the kitchen. But make a big batch of grains and beans, and they last in the refrigerator for up to a week easily. You can even freeze a batch if you need to, if you're not going to get to eating them. But then, again, you have the beans and the grains to just go to. And there's a great variety of grains. You know, yes, there's brown rice, and of course we all know about quinoa now, but millet is really great, amaranth is great. You know, there's, you know, lots of different rices. I mean, black forbidden rice is great, Bhutanese red rice is great. So you can really, you know, switch it up so it's not all the same. Buy half as much meat and make it better quality. And I talk about that a lot too. We, you know, for those of you that are still eating meat out there, try to choose meat that is raised, pasture-raised, grass-fed, know the farmer. I mean, how incredible would that be to know that you're supporting someone trying to do it the right way? It's not cheap to raise cattle and to do it the right way, but it's the right way to do it. And so purchase good quality meat and use it also as a condiment, as a seasoning. You know, instead of meat being the focus of the meal, add the meat into a stir fry or into a stew so it gives the flavor you're craving, but you're not eating so much of it. And then, you know, save some money for some treats, you know, some good chocolate, you know, if you want to make a treat. I've been making some really incredible raw desserts that are almost guilt-free. I mean, they just stay in the freezer because you're making a whole round cheesecake size or tart pan size dessert. And you just take a little sliver and it stays in the freezer, and it's just tart and sweet and delicious all at the same time. And you can switch it up. You can put different fruits in it, and you can put chocolate on it, and it just stays. And then, you know, instead of going and getting that ice cream when you're craving something sweet in the freezer, you have this beautiful raw dessert that's sweetened with agave or maple syrup. You know, the cheesecake part or the creamy part is made from cashews, no dairy, and it's really wonderful. You can find those recipes on my website at ieatgreen.com. Also, if the vegetables are not in season, you're better off buying frozen vegetables where they freeze them when they are in season. You can have better flavor from that. Check out making some pickles. You can make pickles really easily and quickly, and those last for days in the fridge. And, you know, they're really wonderful. Make bean dips and nut butters and spreads like hummus, black bean dip, arugula, pesto, those kind of things that you can just spread on crackers or bread, you know, when you're craving a snack or dip, you know, dip fresh vegetables into them. And they're great. And then, you know, that helps you eat more vegetables. And, you know, so many people are big on vitamins, but the truth is if you eat well, you don't need to be taking vitamins. Your body doesn't absorb them very well, and you are going to get much better quality of nutrition if you get it directly from the fruit and vegetables. You can also make those green smoothies in the morning, but again, I'd rather use the vegetables and the fruits for my nutrients as opposed to adding, you know, protein powders and things like that. Also, going back to the New York Times article, they suggest you cook plants as you would meat. They talk about fried eggplant. I'd like to suggest that you actually bake it in the oven instead of frying it. It really works great. Just put a little olive oil down on a cookie sheet and put your eggplant on that, and they toast up really beautifully right in the oven, and then you don't have to fry them up. And what else do they recommend? Cooking for carnivores, make extra sides. So make lots of vegetables, side vegetables, so that even if you're cooking for people that are enjoying eating meat, that they're also really expanding their palate to incorporate so many really delicious vegetables. And then this also suggests you cook out of your comfort zone, although so many of my listeners, I know this is your comfort zone. Braising tofu, sautéing tofu, tempeh, seitan, those are all incredible meat alternatives that I work with all the time, and they're wonderful. So try those. The recipe I'm going to share with you today is a hearty winter lentil soup, which is wonderful for a day like today. We're going to be getting snow here in New York. We have a little dusting now, but it's not snowing right now. But it's supposed to pick up by later this afternoon, and we're supposed to get, I've heard 8 to 10 inches, and I've heard 1 to 2 feet, so take your pick. But either way, we are planning on getting some snow today, and that's guaranteed. So a hearty winter lentil soup is a wonderful thing to warm your belly. So this is what you need for this hearty winter lentil soup. 16 cups of water. And I like to use filtered water. I have a filter on my sink so that the water I get out of there is filtered. You know, if you don't have that, you can use Brita filtered water or buy some bottled water. But I have a real problem with bottled water, and I know I've talked to you many times about this as well. The plastic is really not great. You don't know how much it's traveled cross-country to get to you or where it's come from. And if the water's been sitting in a hot truck, that's certainly not good. The plastic leaches into the water. And then what do you do with the plastic bottles when you're finished? So I've really been trying to do away with as much of the plastic water bottles as possible. It's certainly wonderful if you're out on the road and you're thirsty. I'd rather get a bottle of water than a soda or a juice. But it's still wonderful if you have a filter on your water. I even, you know, stopped drinking seltzer and Pellegrino and those things and then bought myself a soda stream, also with a glass bottle. They sell them with water, with plastic bottles and glass bottles, and the glass bottle is certainly preferable for the same reasons. So anyway, 16 cups of water, 3 tablespoons olive oil, 4 carrots diced, 3 stalks of celery diced, 4 parsnips diced, 15 cloves of garlic minced. I like a lot of garlic, and it's really great to keep you healthy in the winter months. A two-inch piece of ginger, also great for you during this cold season. 2 cans of diced organic tomatoes, 1.5 cups of potatoes, diced, 2 cups of French lentils rinsed. If you don't have French lentils and you want to use regular green lentils, even red lentils, you can certainly do that. 2 teaspoons of cumin, 2 bay leaves, 2 cups of prepared tomato sauce, and I buy an organic tomato sauce from either Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, and I use that. And I use that a lot of times as a base for soup, and it's a shortcut. You know, it might be called cheating in some chef's idea, but I'll tell you, as a working mom, it is great. Using tomato sauce and watering it down as a soup base, whenever you want a tomato base broth, it's wonderful. 2 cups of collard greens chopped that I picked right out of my garden. Believe it or not, I still have collard greens, and it's great when you think you don't have anything to go out to the garden, and there they are. And then juice of a lemon, just, gives it that little tweak at the end, and just makes it really over the top. It's wonderful. So I start with a large, heavy soup pot, and I'm going to saute the onions and the celery and the parsnips and the carrots all in the bottom of the pot for about 5 minutes till they really start getting softer. Then I'm going to add the garlic and ginger and continue cooking for a little while. Then I'm going to add the potatoes and let that cook a little bit longer. Then I add the lentils, the diced tomatoes, the cumin, the bay leaves, and the water. And I bring that to a boil. And then let that simmer for about 40 minutes until everything gets really soft. The lentils start breaking up on their own, so you don't need to go into this soup with a immersion blender. You're certainly welcome to if you want it completely smooth, but I like it to be really hearty, and I like the chunks of the vegetables in there. When everything's soft, then add the tomato sauce and the collard greens. I don't want the collard greens to cook too much. I like the color of them still being bright green. But you add the tomato sauce at that point and simmer for about 10 more minutes. If it seems too thick to you, you can add some more water. Adjust for salt and pepper to taste. And then you're going to squeeze some lemon into it right before serving. And you can serve it with a lemon wedge for each person individually, or you can add juice of 1 lemon to the whole pot. And it's really great. Another thing you can also add is hot red pepper flakes. I don't have that in the recipe because sometimes I'm cooking for people who don't like spicy food. But I would add 1/2 teaspoon of red pepper flakes to this if you'd like it to be a little spicier. And it's just delicious. So I hope you all enjoy that. There's some things going on in around the city that I want to make you aware of before I invite Rona on to my guest today. The next Wednesday, January 8th, there is a huge rally planned up in Albany at the state capitol, and I really hope many of you listening will consider buying a ticket and join us on the bus to Albany. There are buses from all around New York State, and we're trying to really make an impact to Governor Cuomo that we do not want fracking in the state of New York. And we really need a lot of people. The rally will be indoors in the Empire State Plaza, in the whole concourse area. We're just going to take over the whole building, depending on how many people we have. But we're really looking for a great showing. I'll be on the bus. If you're on the bus from Long Island, I'll make enough food for everybody on the bus. So please, please join us for this very important rally in Albany. Then on January 10th through the 12th, there's a wonderful conference going on in the city called the Real Truth About Health Conference, and that's at the Times Square Millennium Hotel. If you can't make it, you can also live stream it. Many great speakers. Jeffrey Smith will be there. Brian Clement will be there. So that's worth checking out as well. And then NOFA New York's Winter Conference is coming up. And if you're not in New York, a lot of the NOFA conferences are coming up. So if you can't make the New York Winter Conference, there's the Massachusetts Conference, there's a Vermont Conference, there's a Maine Conference. So check out the NOFA Winter Conferences, whatever state you're in. They're a wonderful gathering. The one in New York happens at the Saratoga Hilton in Saratoga Springs. And it's a wonderful gathering of local farmers who have an opportunity to network, and come together and offer wonderful workshops, and it's very informative. It's a wonderful time to meet people. It's a lot of fun. There's usually music and dancing, as well as documentary films being shown. So if you can make it to that, it's a wonderful thing. January 25th and 26th, there's a beekeeping class taking place in Brooklyn, being hosted by Honeybee Lives. It's at the Commons in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue. And it's a two-day class, and it's an introduction to beekeeping. And this is the time to start thinking about bees. If you want to have bees this year, now is the time to be thinking about it and ordering your bees. So this is a great class. As I said, it's being hosted by Honeybee Lives, and you can find them on the web. February 13th, Edible Manhattan is hosting a Good Spirit event. It's a tasting of local restaurants and with local spirits. And that's on Mercer Avenue from 6 to 9 on February 13th. You can find out more information about that at the Edible Manhattan website. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest today, who is Rona Fried. She is the founder and CEO of a wonderful organization called SustainableBusiness.com. And Rona has been running this business for, you know, many, many years, and I'll let her tell us more about it. But on her website, she also has a wonderful, wonderful job listing called Green Jobs, and she's been doing it since 1996, this website. And it is a wonderful resource for so many people looking for good jobs, working for organizations that care about sustainability. So, Rona, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bhavani.
Sure. Can you start by just telling us a little bit more about sustainable business? Your bio was so long, I felt like it would be better for you to just tell us a little bit about sustainable business.
Oh, it's really pretty simple at this point. We've been on the Internet for 18 years. We were one of the first green business sites in the world to start up, and have kept going all these years. And at this point, we provide daily green business news, and we cover anything that is related to sustainability on the environmental side. So it's from green building to renewable energy to the organic industry, climate change, and everything in between. And we run Green Dream Jobs, which you just mentioned, which is a national green job service that was one of the first in the world to start online. We also connect green businesses with investors. We're going to launch soon a directory that profiles all of the educational programs in the United States where people can get degrees and certificates related to green business.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's amazing how many schools now are really adding master's programs in sustainable business.
And PhD programs and executive development and, you know, solar certificate programs and lots of others, green building and so forth.
And from your experience, do you think that there's enough jobs for all these people graduating with these new degrees?
I don't know about it in this current economy. A lot of these programs got off the ground when President Obama first came into office, and you may remember at that time there was a huge push toward green jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the news. It was everywhere. And there was a lot of money that went out to schools to get these programs off the ground as part of the Recovery Act, which was the stimulus bill. And that's when a lot of this happened. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, there are pendulums that swing back and forth. And I'm not sure how all of these programs are doing, but I do see new ones that keep popping up. So I would imagine they're doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Because that's my concern, you know, for people who go on to these wonderful degrees and come out so inspired and excited. Mm-hmm. And then they hit the job market and it's like, you know, a reality check.
Well, I think it's a tough job market for anybody in any field right now.
I think you're right.
And I think that in our field, there are certain segments of it that are booming, like green building is booming, and it has throughout the recession.
Mm-hmm. Now, green building,
solar installation is booming also. I'm sure there are other areas that I'm, you know, not as in touch with.
Uh-huh. And in green building, are you talking about the LEED certification?
Yes.
And has that changed much over the years?
Oh, yeah. We just posted an article about a week ago. They just came out with their next version of LEED, which is, you know, giant steps beyond the previous versions. They're really doing a fabulous job. But people are getting certified as, you know, green building architects, designers, engineers. You know, there's a whole raft of different skills involved in green building.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as some of the most exciting innovations in that green building segment?
Well, the biggest thing that I was impressed about with this new version of LEED is that they're actually moving from a feature-based system to a solutions-based system. And so for all of these years, and I give the U.S. Green Building Council, who developed LEED, incredible amounts of credit. I mean, they literally created an industry that's now mainstream across the world in just 15 years or so. And basically it's based on giving points for various features in a building. So, you know, they've come up with all of the various features that make a building green, and you get you can pick and choose from which features you want to include in the building, and they add up to certain, you know, total in points, from energy efficiency to how much water the building consumes to how well insulated it is, to whether you incorporate renewable energy, whether it's sited properly near mass transit. You know, there's a whole raft of factors. And then you add them up, and then the building ends up with either a silver, gold, or platinum certification, depending on how many of those you've incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're changing that to coming up with a bunch of targets that buildings need to meet rather than those features included. They're kind of assuming now that most people know how to do that, and the bar is not that high anymore, that most people have learned how to make buildings more energy efficient and so forth, and they're doing it, and so they're raising the bar so that they're coming up with targets for how much the building helps with climate change. You know, how much the building, you know, makes a difference in the community. There's a whole series of now targets like that,
mm-hmm.
which are, you know, obviously the end point that we're all trying to get to is solutions rather than just features.
Right. Like, couldn't you imagine if every new building was required to have a sustainable garden, a roof garden on their
Right. Well, they get points for that right now, but they're mm-hmm. not required. But, you know, the more that they want to meet these particular solutions, the more they'll need to incorporate those kinds of things.
Right. And do you think the more that they're used, the more affordable they will become? I mean, like, I know there's technology. You know, every couple of years, my husband and I go to Germany to this big conference called Glass Tech, where they have really great innovations in solar and photovoltaic and all these different more sustainable solutions. And, you know, there's photovoltaic chips in all this glass that you could have line a whole side of a building with glass that is photovoltaic, and so you can actually run all the energy for that building off of, you know, the energy that is generated every day from the sun. And those kind of things that would just be so amazing if, you know, if the buildings didn't need to go onto the grid and could be self-sustaining.
Well, that's the direction we're moving in for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And so LEED is the one that's taking the lead in that, no pun intended.
Well, LEED has always taken the lead, and unfortunately, industry is always ready to, you know, greenwash it. And so there is a group called Green Globes, which is industry-backed. You can imagine there's a lot of different industries out there that don't like LEED.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the chemical industry, because LEED fosters the use of, you know, benign chemicals in building products.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical industry doesn't like that. You know, there's a whole bunch of industries that are invested in seeing, you know, LEED not succeed further. And they've started their own certification process called Green Globes, which they're trying to get in various places instead of LEED. The forestry industry does the same thing with well-managed forest products. You know, the benchmark there for excellence is the Forest Certification Council, FSC. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you may see, like, the FSC label on wood products and paper products and so forth. Well, there's a competing label there, too, SFI, Sustainable Forestry Initiative. That's an industry-backed initiative that does the same thing. They have tons of loopholes, and, you know, but they come across as if they're the same, and they're not. And so
right.
People can get easily fooled by these things.
Uh-huh. So which is the better one?
FSC by far. In both the FSC case and the LEED case, one of the key differences is that they were both developed based on a consensus-driven process of all the various stakeholders in these industries. And so they're not, you know, top-down industry-led processes. They're consensus-driven.
And the I'm sorry, just to go back to FSC, what's the C stand for?
Certification. Forest Stewardship Council. I'm sorry, FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certification. So that's the group that came up with the very meaningful and deep process to make sure that our wood and paper products come from well-managed forests.
Great.
As opposed to clear-cut, you know, unmanaged forests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's, you know, big pushes in so many of the organic industries for certification, you know, to have a third party really give it the okay, whether it's the DMO project,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's GMO certification, so that even if something's organic, you want to have that certification just to make sure that there's been no cross-contamination. And, you know, it's just those kind of programs really
right. Well,
popping
kudos,
up, which we
kudos
need.
To the organic industry, which was the only industry ever that actually wanted more stringent criteria. I mean, when you think of industries, they need to be regulated because left alone to their own devices, you know, they do things only for profit, which means cutting corners in 1,000 different ways. And the organic industry is really the only industry in the world that set its own criteria from the beginning, wanted it to be as stringent as possible because they had higher goals of, you know, environmental sanity as opposed to just making money off of the land.
Right. But there's the USDA organic, that is really run by the government that does not have the same stringent
well,
you know, certification.
They've allowed
industry into that organization and has weakened its validity. So that's why, just like with this forestry certification, you have to know which organization to pay attention to.
That's right. And it's really unfortunate, actually. I do wonder sometimes why the organic industry pushed so hard for USDA to take over their certification. I mean, I remember at the time, I think this happened during the early, mid-90s or something, because I remember following it. They wanted, you know, the marketing and the consumer acceptance that they felt could come from a government seal as opposed to an industry seal.
Mm-hmm.
And the organic industry is who they pushed for the USDA to take it over. And it is unfortunate, but because the USDA is infiltrated by people from Monsanto and other industry participants, in addition to the organic industry, who was also present there, some of the standards have been diluted, but I still think it is an excellent label that people can trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to believe in something, right?
Yeah.
You have to believe in something. So
yeah.
I wanted just to pick your brain a little bit about the organic agriculture and the, you know, and how that affects climate change? Because I know you're very connected to both sides of the sustainable business. And so can you share with some of my listeners how organic agriculture can actually help be a solution for climate change?
Organic agriculture is probably our biggest solution to climate change, believe it or not. The more photosynthesis that we have on Earth, the more carbon is taken out of the atmosphere. It's really a very direct connection. And part of the reason why we're having this problem with excess carbon in the atmosphere is because we've cut down our forests. And so rather than absorbing carbon, they emit carbon as they're cut down. And when they're cut down, the soils are also destroyed, and so the soil can no longer absorb carbon. Soil is a major carbon sink. And so as we've degraded our soils through various ways, whether it's been cutting forests or conventional agriculture, which with petroleum inputs, pesticides and everything else, which kills the soil and all the microorganisms within it, whether it's very poor practices in grazing animals on land, all of these things come together to basically have destroyed the soils on our planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soils are no longer acting as carbon sponges, and the plants are no longer there to absorb the carbon. And so all the other bad stuff that we're doing, emitting fossil fuels, has no counterbalance at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, isn't the production of meat and chicken
right.
and dairy also produces so much greenhouse gas?
Because of the way that we do it and on the scale that we do it. So believe it or not, agriculture is responsible for 20% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions.
I thought it was even more.
It's 20%, the animals that we raise, the cows and so forth, are responsible for 15% out of that 20%. So it's mostly coming from those animals.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean it's kind of an even split. Another 15% comes from transportation. Another 15% comes from power plants and so forth. So, I mean, it's kind of like an even split between all of those sectors of our economy. So agriculture is even more than the others, because if we had a good, strong soil system, it would be counteracting a lot of the problems that we're causing in the other sectors.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the movement to replant forests? Are we still tearing down at the rate that we had been tearing down, and are they trying to bring back any forests?
This is a very frustrating topic. There have been lots of large moves where I felt like we were finally going to tackle this issue over the years in various ways. That basically the major countries of the world may have made many agreements, signed several agreements, that no more forests were going to be cut. We were going to keep our primary rainforests, and we were going to restore others. And some years you read that it's working and that deforestation rates are way down. Other years they go back up.
Mm-hmm.
So Brazil, for example, had made a lot of progress on reducing deforestation in the Amazon. And then this year, I've been reading that it's up again.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil is also in the midst of doing what I think of as a mind-numbing, terrible program. I can't imagine how anybody in their right mind can do this. But the president of Brazil, who happens to be a female, has embarked on this enormous hydro dam building spree of 19 major dams in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. And, you know, you can imagine how that affects the indigenous people that live there. And the it's hard to even talk about how terrible it is. And I would, you know, if people want to know more about it, they can go to my website and put in Amazon in the search engine, and you'll quickly find these articles. You can put in dam building, you know, hydro, whatever you want, it'll come up.
Wow.
But there's, you know, lots and lots of resistance right now in Brazil around this. Some of these tribes are even uncontacted, previously uncontacted tribes that are now, you know, just not able to live that way anymore. You know, they build these dams, and it changes the ecology completely to the point where it's actually reduced already. They haven't even finished the first dam. And there's so much resistance, you know, they're there blocking the dams from being built on the ground. Mm. But the rainfall has actually decreased already some 10%.
Just really?
Yeah, it's incredible to think about that. And the very...
Well, that's the thing that we just, in our society, it's just mind-boggling how interconnected everything is, and people just think everything is a standalone situation.
That's right.
They make a decision without, you know, the American Indians had a great saying, just, you know, it's like before you make a decision, think of how it's going to affect seven generations down.
Yeah.
You know, and that we don't think like that, you know. What's good for today might not be good for our grandchildren's children.
Right. And well, this isn't even good for today.
Right.
I really don't understand why they're doing it, because Brazil has, you know, made so many statements over the years about their commitment to fighting climate change, preserving the Amazon, and so forth.
Well,
and
every government makes certain,
right.
You know, that's the problem with governments. I mean, every government talks like they care and then makes decisions that's completely bogus. I mean, Canada's in the midst of that with the, you know, with the tar sands. And,
oh, God.
You know, I mean, it could just go on and on. Before we go on and on, though, let's take a couple-minute break, and we come back. I want to bring it back a little bit towards some of the agriculture and GMO labeling, what's really going on here in this country, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest is Rona Fried from SustainableBusinesses.com. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Rona Fried from SustainableBusiness.com, and she is here talking to us about what is big in sustainable business and what her company does. And Rona, are you with me?
Uh-huh.
Good. So when we were just talking about Brazil and Canada and all the poor decisions they make, along with some of the poor decisions our country makes. And one of them, I think, has to do with the GMO labeling, genetically modified organisms. And it's amazing to me there's still people out there in our country that do not know what GMOs are. And our country still has chosen not to regulate them or label them at all. Can you tell me a little bit about... tell me a little bit about how you see the future of GMO labeling going and what you think people can do to help change the regulations in this country.
Well, there's a very active movement right now to get GMO labeling. It almost passed in California, and then it almost passed in Washington State in this last election. And it keeps failing, not because people don't want GMO labeling, but because the big industry comes in at the very last minute with tons and tons of millions and millions of dollars that with misinformation, and the voters end up turning it down, even though up till 2 weeks before the election, some 65% of voters in Washington State were in favor of GMO labeling. At the election itself, it went below 50%, and it lost by 2 points.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, the same happened in California.
Yep.
And these big industries are using fear tactics, and they're using millions and millions of dollars that the GMO campaign just doesn't have that kind of money to pour in to counterbalance the GMO labeling.
Right, which is true in every case. I mean, if you look at the tar sands problem, it's big industry versus environmental activists.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in our country as well in as in so many countries, big business has become a more important constituent than the
yes.
actual voters because they get to vote with their money.
Yes, and we keep giving them more money because we keep cutting their taxes and allowing them to have tax havens outside the country and allowing them not to have, you know, pay taxes if they've made money outside the country, so they hide it outside the country. And so they just keep accumulating more and more and more wealth to fight all of these things that our society needs.
Mm-hmm. Any suggestions? What organization do you think is the most successful or the most, you know, the best one for people to get involved with in fighting the GMO labeling? I know there's GMO Free New York. You know, what organization do you feel is a really great business model for people to work with?
Well, I think the Organic Consumers Union has been doing a great job on GMO labels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's really interesting is that right now, the industry is actually pushing Congress to pass a voluntary GMO labeling law. And so that's their latest way of getting around, this inevitability of, at some point, a state is going to pass this referendum on this, and then other states will follow. And so they know that's inevitable, and so instead of fighting it state by state, they've decided to, they prefer if Congress passes a really weak voluntary labeling law.
Yeah, which is bogus, right? What does
right.
that mean?
Which would just get them off the hook.
Mm-hmm. It means nothing. But what people don't realize is how genetically modified ingredients have infiltrated all of our regular everyday products, like 90% of the products in the supermarket that are processed foods contain genetically modified ingredients. I know, you know, as a vegetarian chef from way back when, I used to use grape nuts in my vegetarian chili to act like a mock meat, you know, and it gave the look and it didn't get soggy. It held up in the chili really wonderfully. And then when I found out about the genetically modified stuff, I went to Kashi brand. They make a wheat nugget that looked the same, and I also, you know, my kids loved having grape nuts in their yogurt, so I would buy the Kashi brand. And then I found out Kashi was bought out by a big
mm-hmm.
company, and then they started using genetically modified ingredients. And so, you know, they can substitute the word natural for organic, and voila, in come genetically modified ingredients. I know I was shocked to find out the company Silk.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, you know, people have brand loyalty and they've, you know, been buying Silk organic tofu forever.
Soy milk was the big one.
Right, soy milk. And then one day, next thing you know, instead of saying organic, it says natural.
Right, and if you've been buying it for years, you really don't look at the carton anymore.
Right.
And all
really
of a sudden, one day I looked at it for some reason, and I was like, what is this? And they didn't change the price. It was still priced for an organic product.
Uh-huh.
They were so
sweet. Of course.
And all of a sudden it says natural on it. And I look at the ingredients and I see there's nothing organic in it anymore. So you're
right.
Absolutely eating GMO soy because that's soy milk. So it's basically everything you're imbibing through that.
Right.
So, you know, what I always say to people is, if you care about this stuff, you know, so many people don't really make a commitment to buying organic. But just making that commitment and sticking with it and actually doing it, you know, affects all of the various things that we're talking about here. So
right.
when people say, well, it costs 10 cents less or something, why would I bother with the organic? I can just get this, you know, other thing, whatever product it is, whatever food product, it does make a big difference, because we're talking about the difference between, first of all, supporting an industry that is building our soils and protecting us from climate change and doing things right, you know, in all sorts of ways, you know, caring for biodiversity, you know, our bees, our butterflies, our, you know, everything are dependent on organic agriculture. They're being decimated by GMOs, and, you know, there's actually research out now that GMOs are a big problem for the declining populations of bees and butterflies.
Oh, yeah. I had that in my newsletter this week. I mean, there's a, there's, you know, the beekeeping pesticide that is in the pesticides that they're using now that are absolutely, you know, horrible for the bees, and it's also causing, damage to people's health as well. I mean, it's
right.
Just,
well, it goes hand in hand.
It's just
and so
terrible.
If there was one New Year's resolution I would ask your listeners to make, if they haven't already, is to buy organic.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really has such an effect on so many aspects of our lives, from supporting people who are doing the right thing to supporting people in developing countries that we import from that depend on agriculture for their livelihood. And we really don't want them to have to depend on pesticide-laden GMO agriculture, which actually, you know, uses much less labor. And so these people have been farming organically and sustainably for thousands of years, and then all of a sudden they become farmhands if they even have a job anymore.
Mm-hmm. Would you say organic agriculture produces the same, less, or more jobs than conventional agriculture?
It absolutely produces way more jobs.
It does?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because it's labor-intensive. So
right.
You need people to do so many more things.
Right.
In organic agriculture, because they're not relying on petrochemical inputs and pesticides. They're relying on labor, on people.
Right.
To do those
right.
things, pick off insects. You know, whatever it is, it's being done by people, not machines.
Right. You know, and yet we also have to support, you know, fair wages, because, you know, to get, you know, when they hire these farm laborers and they pay them sometimes even below minimum wage or minimum wage, I mean, it's so hard to support yourself
mm-hmm.
these days on that lower salary, you know.
There's every reason to buy organic, and it doesn't cost very much more anymore. I mean, personally, I don't even look, so I have no comparison. You know, this is the way I want to eat. This is, it's healthy for me, my dog, the planet, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it costs 25 cents more or a dollar more, or, you know, that is not going to make as big a difference in my life as eating healthy food is.
You know, but for people that are on a really fixed budget, those dollars really add up. And so that's why when I was talking about making a big batch of grains at the beginning of the week and
batch
of beans, that's cheap.
Exactly.
That's cheap.
Anything in the bulk
food.
Area, beans, I mean, that's the basis of a healthy diet.
Right, and that's cheap, you know, I won't say cheap, that's inexpensive
yeah.
to make. You. There's so many different beans, so many different grains.
Right.
You can really, you know, make quite a variety and then try to shop around and look where you can get different things. I mean, I look at Trader Joe's, for instance, versus Whole Foods, and I shop at both.
Mm-hmm.
But you can buy organic tomato sauce at Trader Joe's for a dollar less a jar than Whole
and
Foods.
And you can
buy
make
organic
yourself just as easily with a can of tomatoes. Making it is not some of these things which people do pay a lot of money for, whether it's soup, you know, or tomato sauce or salad dressing. All of these things are made so easily at home with inexpensive whole ingredients.
Yeah, it's true. You know, but you can buy organic, less expensive, if you just pay attention and shop around.
Mm-hmm.
So I really recommend people, you know, spending that little bit of extra time to find out where the less expensive items are, and then you get familiar with it, and you don't have to spend all that time figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
You can just go to it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it really does make a difference, like you said, on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also trying to buy things when they're in season and then freezing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, you can go strawberry picking or,
mm-hmm.
you know, and be getting unsprayed organic strawberries and then freezing them when they're in season.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have them throughout the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really nice thing to do, because to buy strawberries nowadays, you know, in the middle of the winter, they're coming from California, they're sprayed with a horrible pesticide,
mm-hmm.
and they've traveled all that way. So
mm-hmm.
it's not the best option.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, what is biogas? People hear about that all the time, and I don't think most people know what that is.
Well, this is something that I really wanted to talk about today, because with all of our discussions about fracking and protests against fracking,
mm-hmm.
biogas is a natural form of natural gas. It is a substitute. We don't need to be pulling out natural gas from the ground, because we have a natural form of it, and it's called methane. And what biogas does is it is a process that transforms methane into renewable energy and organic fertilizer. And so we have huge methane, and this is such a democratic form of energy because it's everywhere. It's in waste treatment plants make methane. All the dairies
methane
make
worse for the environment than...
Excuse me?
Methane, isn't that very bad for the environment?
Well, when it's put through this process, it is converted into renewable energy. There's no release of methane.
Okay.
It's a completely clean process, and the feedstocks are in all 50 states. And the projections are that we could create almost 300,000 jobs through this emerging industry, which is emerging. The first large-scale biogas plant opened recently in California, and there are hundreds of them now on dairy farms all over the country. The dairy industry, by the way, made a commitment to cut their climate emissions. I think it's like 20% by 2015 or something. I don't remember the exact target. But one of the big ways they're doing it is that they are taking the waste on their own farms and they're putting it into these biogas plants, which then provide energy for their farms, clean energy, and organic fertilizer, which they then can spread on their farms. And it also can be captured from landfills. You know, landfills produce methane. So there are lots of different sources for this, but this is, you know, completely biogas prevents methane emissions, and it has the potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by hundreds of millions of tons a year. Like, I'm just reading now, the equivalent of taking 30 million cars off the road. You know, in contrast, obviously, natural gas pollutes the air and the water, causes earthquakes and every other bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for it.
So what is the holdup then, if that's so readily available?
Your guess is as good as mine. Obviously, the holdup is that there's a very powerful fossil fuel industry that wants to keep fossil fueling. You know, if everybody was on the same page of, you know, we need to address climate change, you know, things would be different, but we're not all on the same page. We're all on different pages, and it's all about who's making profit where.
Mm-hmm. Now, the methane is only being produced really by the factory farms, or is it on all farms?
It's produced from wastewater treatment plants as part of the wastewater treatment process, and it's produced from landfills. As food especially degrades in landfills, it turns into methane, which mm-hmm. is one good reason why everybody should be composting. So we shouldn't be sending food to landfills. And so what this process does, you can look it up, biogas. You can certainly look it up on our site. We've written numerous articles about it. It captures the methane, and it turns it into clean energy.
Mm-hmm. And people can run their cars on this, too, no?
Absolutely, yes. It could be a transportation fuel, and it could be the same as using natural gas. It is the final product of biogas is natural gas without the emissions.
Amazing. Well, thank you for sharing that with everyone, because that really sounds exciting.
It is.
And I would like to learn more about that. So, Rona, before we run out of time, can you share with everyone your website again, how they can get in touch with you and find out more about this stuff?
Just go to sustainablebusiness.com. We produce about 5 news stories a day. You can sign up to receive our news stories via email. Obviously, we have a Facebook page and a Twitter feed for people that use that. That's all right on our site. And I hope that people who are interested in employment in green, check out Green Dream Jobs. We have really exciting, really diverse job postings there.
Great. Well, thank you, Rona. And thanks for the work that you do. You really are out there. You've been doing it for a long time, and you're really making a difference. So on behalf of myself and everybody else who cares about this planet, thank you.
Thank you, Bhavani.
Okay. Everyone out there, have a great rest of the first week of 2014, and I'll be with you all again next Thursday. Have a great one. Bye for now.